Providence. This is a term probably, and this is review, this is a term probably we've heard many times if we've been a Christian for very long, God's providence. But how many times is the word providence or God's providence used in the Bible, anywhere in the Old Testament or the New Testament? Anybody remember? It's never used. That term, that word, is not used. But there are some different words that are used to talk about God's providence. You have the word provide and provision, to where God provides and that you have God laying aside provisions for His people. And the word provide means to take precautionary measures for, to make a proviso for, to supply something wanting. And the word provision means a measure taken beforehand to deal with a need or contingency, preparation. So based on the definition of these two words, when we talk about God's providence, how would you define providence? Okay. Okay, so God provides for His people. He takes care of the needs. Anyone else? Okay. Okay, that's good. Duke? Okay, continuous, I like that, continuous activity in within man's lives and within the world itself. Is God's providence limited, as we've already seen, to just Christians or just His people? No, He is active in all parts of the world. Now, there are specific ways that He is active in a Christian's life, but He is active in all aspects of the world. We need to understand that. And when you start to think about this, and as we progress in this class, and we're going to probably start next week taking a look at the book of Esther and how his providence was active within the life of Esther and within the nation of Israel, and then you multiply that activity by the thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, His people, on the earth. And then you multiply that by how He is active in all the nations of the earth. It's mind-boggling to think about that power and the magnitude of who He is. And so hopefully by the end of the class we'll have a better vision of the power of God than maybe than we've had in the past as we look at specifics and apply it to specifics. And we've looked at three different principles that we have to remember when talking about the providence of God. And the first one is that providence must be distinguished from the miraculous. When it comes to God's providence, as we've already seen and studied, He does not use the miraculous. He uses the natural laws and stays within the natural laws of the world. Secondly, He never operates in a way that is in conflict with His nature. He is righteous. He is good. He does not lie. He does not tempt people. And we need to understand, when you take a look at situations and you take a look at things that are going on within the world and maybe within your own life, you can't, you got to understand that if it's evil, if it's sin, God had nothing to do with it. He does not go against His nature. If He does, He stops being what? Or who? God. I mean, that's not going to happen. And then the third is that divine providence does not negate man's freedom of will. And we look specifically at Pharaoh when it says there that God hardened his heart. God is not going to cause anybody to go to hell. He's not going to cause anybody to sin. When you take a look more closely, as we did, I think it was 2 weeks ago, at the passages in the scriptures within Exodus, it's clearly obvious Pharaoh had a choice in the matter. He chose wrong in his reaction to God's power is what hardened his heart. But it was his choice. It was his choice. God's not going to cause anybody to do wrong, to do evil. Okay? He will not do that. And so when we take a look at providence, we have to remember these three principles. But there's one more principle I think we have to fully understand in relation to providence when we talk about providence. And that's what I want to talk about this morning, is that fourth principle. And that fourth principle is there's also another player in all of this. Satan. We cannot forget his activity within our lives. Is Satan active within a Christian's life? He sure is. Is he active within the world itself? He's the prince of this world. I think Paul uses the phrase the God of this world, lowercase g. He is active in all of this. And we can never forget his activity and how much he is active. But when you take a look at his activity in the world, you will also see God's providence fully displayed as well within Satan's activity in the world. And that's what I want to talk about, as I said, for a few moments. And what I want to do is we could take a look at any character, biblical character, but I want to go over to the book of Job and spend just a few moments within the book of Job itself as we talk about Satan's activity, because I think when we take a look at the first couple chapters specifically of the book of Job, we see how all this comes to fruition, and we see exactly how this is applicable, I think, to understanding providence and the providence of God. I want to take a look at the first five verses, first of all, and take a look at what's said about Job in the first five verses. There was a man in the land of Uz, whose name was Job, and the man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, and 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the east. And his sons went and feasted in their houses, every one his day, and sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be, but my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. What do we learn about Job in these first five verses? Okay, he was an upright and righteous man. What else? He was rich. He feared God. He was rich. Where did those blessings come from, you suppose? God. I think we see God's providence here within these first five verses. I think we see the blessings. Now, does that mean that God's going to bless all of his people with wealth? No. But we see a specific example of the type of blessing that God will and sometimes does give to his people. And as we'll see at the end of this class, with blessings come what? Responsibility. With talent, and this is a talent, come responsibilities. And so I just want to point that out as we continue. But the last phrase here in verse 5, I think, verse 1 and the last phrase of verse 5, last clause of verse 5. When you see he was a perfect, upright man that feared God, verse 1, and hated evil, and thus did Job continually, I think says much to us about the type of man that Job was. And how does Satan react to Job? What's his reaction to this godly man? Okay.
Things.
Yeah.
Take it away.
Take it away, and we'll see what's going to happen. Turn over to Revelation chapter 12 for just a second, and notice what's said there in verse 10 concerning the activity of Satan. I think we're going to, and we're going to read Job 1 here in the next few verses, but Revelation 12 and verse 10, keep in mind. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. What's being said there about Satan? What's he doing? Doing what? Blaspheming, accusing God's people. What's he about? What are we about to read in the book of Job? What's he about to do to Job? He's making accusations against Job. Notice, as we look through the next few verses. Now, there was a certain day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. I don't want to talk about verse 6, so don't ask any questions, Ken Brown, about verse 6, okay? But verse 7, and the Lord said unto Satan, whence comest thou? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job? And there is none like him in the earth, a perfect man and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and about his house, and about all that he hath on his every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. And put forth thine hand now, and touch all that he has, and he will curse thee to thy face. What do we see Satan doing here in these verses? He's questioning two people, actually. And God, too. Is he not? He's questioning both Job and God. But specifically, we're going to center on Job here. And what is it he questions? Because I think this question in verse 9, and he continues with it through verse 11, is very important in many different ways. What's the question?
Is it true faith?
Is Job's faith true? Or is it he's just rejoicing in what you have given him? I like the way...
kept the faith, and he's a poor man.
Yeah.
And he kept the faith.
Yeah.
Matthew Henry, I like his comments here on it. Yeah, I know it's long, but I want to read them to you. While we are on this earth, we are within his reach, Satan. Hence it concerns us to be sober and vigilant, 1 Peter 5:8. See how Satan censures Job. This is the common way of slanderers, to suggest that which they have no reason to think is true. But as there is nothing we should dread more than really being hypocrites, so there is nothing we need dread less than being called and counted so without cause. It is not wrong to look at the eternal recompense in our obedience, but it is wrong to aim at worldly advantages in our religion. God's people are taken under his special protection, they and all that belong to them. The blessing of the Lord makes rich. Satan himself owns it. God suffered Job to be tried as he suffered Peter to be sifted. It is our comfort that God has the devil on a chain, Revelation chapter 20 and verse 1. He has no power to lead men to sin, but what they give him themselves, nor any power to afflict men, but what is given him from above. All this is here described to us after the manner of men. The Scripture speaks thus to teach us that God directs the affairs of the world. The key point that I think Matthew Henry is making here is that who is in control? God. In everything. Which points to what? Which is what we're studying. God's what? Providence. God's control. Okay, and when you look at the example of Job, when you look everywhere else in the Scriptures, you see the control of God. And verse 12 is a key verse here. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, all that he hath is in thy power, only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. What does verse 12 in the context of providence pointing to? What does it point to? That's right. God has control not only over us, but over Satan and what he can and cannot do. Another verse in the New Testament that points to this. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 in verse 13. Let's go over there and read that. And after I read that, the question I'm going to ask is, how or where do we see God's providence in 1 Corinthians 10, 13? First Corinthians 10 and verse 13. As soon as I get there. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that which you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that you may be able to bear it. Where do we see God's providence in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13? There is a way of escape. He will, what's one of those words? Provide. You're getting ahead of me. But that's okay. You're exactly right. He provides that way of escape. But also in the context of Job, what else does 1 Corinthians 10 tell us? He limits the temptation. He does both. He is in control. So when we are going through difficulties, when Satan is attacking us, this may be hard to comprehend and understand when we're being attacked and tried and tempted, when we're going through the difficulties, when it seems as if we're not going to get through the day and we're not going to see tomorrow, that is an example of what? God's providence. Because it is something that God believes we are able to do what? We can overcome it. We can bear it. He is not going to let us be overwhelmed. We may become despondent. Did Job become disappointed? Did Job become despondent? Did he ever get tempted to the point he was overwhelmed and his faith left him? See, God's not going to allow that to happen. And we need to that's providence. That's his provisions for us. Jacob?
I've been thinking here, 1 Corinthians 10, 13, about God is faithful. You know, that tells us that God doesn't change, that his nature is always the same. And I think in this verse especially, he's faithful throughout time, as long as there's still people on this earth. And as long as he still has his people, that he is faithful to the promise that he's not going to allow Satan to overtake us unless we make the choice that we want Satan to overtake us in sin. Then we can be overtaken. But God, on his end, he is faithful that he's always going to give us a way out.
And we go back to principle three. I don't have it up here, but we go back to principle three, where God does not negate man's freedom of will, his freedom to choose. So if we give in and we give up, who's at fault? God? It's our choice.
Nor forsake you. In verse 6, so we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear. What can man, and you might put in parentheses, or Satan, do to me?
Well, they're one of his agents.
That's what he uses. So, yeah. Kenneth?
Through this lesson here, we've learned one thing, that Satan's got more work with the faithful than the unfaithful, because he already has them.
Absolutely.
So we have to be aware.
You see him attacking the faithful. Absolutely. Very good. Anyone else? Yeah, Jim.
Your statement as far as God in control of everything, and then this, what we just looked at, with our own free will. So, and your earlier statement that we have a responsibility. So, when I'm putting those complicated ideas together, that he is ultimately in control. He decides the ultimate destination, but we have a responsibility. And if you use the verse that you had from Revelations 11 and
12.
Oh, yeah, 12. 10, I'm thinking 12, 11.
Yeah.
And they said they did not love their life even to death. They didn't even love their life. So as we become more responsible Christians, we recognize it's not about us and it's about Him. But for those that love their life, again, I'm thinking of your earlier statement, God's in control of everything.
Just a second. Hold on to that thought. That's an excellent thought.
And you're putting it together with where I'm going with a point I want to make. But very quickly, what are the three ways that Satan attacks today? First John. Right of life. Now, you know, we use those three, and they're very general. But what I want to do is just very quickly take a look about how what Satan took for a moment. And you see how I think this is an application of 1 John 2. He attacked Job's family. So I want you to understand that this is still the way that Satan attacks today. How do those three areas, how do you apply those three areas to what areas? And as you think about Christians today, and as you think about how Satan still attacks Christians today, I think you'll see these four areas still being attacked today. Does Satan attack families today? Or you get into a verbal discussion with another family member or your own child. Yes?
Indeed. Finances.
Job's finances are attacked. What happened to all his material blessings that God had given to him? Lost it all within a day. Boom. What's the number one reason marriages are impacted in America today? Finances. You think he attacks Christians with financial problems to cause problems within relationships? You think that's still done today? His marriage was subverted. Spouse turned against spouse. What was the response of his wife when all this was going on? Curse God and die. He attacked his marriage. And who is your spouse? How would you describe your spouse? Which should be, let's put it this way. How would you, in God, what God wants with a spouse? Best friend. The one individual, when you choose a spouse, young people, you want to choose somebody that's going to help you get to heaven. That's who you're choosing. That's what your spouse should be, somebody that helps you get to heaven. In this case, Job's spouse did what? Discouraged him, was a stumbling block. And then the last way that Satan attacked Job here, his health was destroyed. Health problems cause people a lot of issues in their faith. Sure do. But you look at these four. I think when you look at Job, you see the application. So how does the pride of life and the lust of the flesh and the lust, how does all that deal? What does he specifically do with the? I think when you look at Job, you see four areas where those could be applied, and you say, yeah, this is what he does. And you still see his activity today taking place. But the point of all this is that, yes, this is allowed to take place, but what is 1 Corinthians 10? Job 1, verse 12. What do we know about God's providence? All of this is what? Limited to what we can bear. Always. It's limited. To what we can bear.
Kind of knows what we can bear. Some people can bear more than others, right? Mm-hmm. So we have people that has more resilience than others. And
well,
Job seemed to be a very
hold
unique.
On that thought.
Hold on to that thought. We're going to get to that in just a second. Here, next slide.
This verse is sometimes used out of context. It's not what we can bear on our own.
No, that's right.
It's what we can bear with God's help. Because if we're trying to do it on our own, we're not going to make it.
Yeah. It's a good point. One last point here,
other area that he does. He uses his friends to attack, to negatively impact him. Now, who are other than our spouses and other in our family who are our best friends, who should be our best friends. Christians, what is the one thing that causes a lot of people to lose faith? When you have problems, where? And when you have your brothers or sisters let you down, it can impact you tremendously, can it not? Has it not caused a lot of people to lose their faith? Job had everything hit upon him. And how quickly did most of this come? Was it years? Days. Days. It hit him.
It shouldn't surprise us, though, because if we are truly a cohesive group of Christians, we're to be just as family.
Yep.
Some of the worst fights you can ever have are with family.
Yep.
So really, if his friends are truly as close with him as Christians should be, it's a family fight.
Yeah, it's a family
discussion that's taking place. Very good. Now think about verse 8 of Job 1. Now think about verse 8. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou, because a lot of you are wanting to get to this, so let's go ahead and get to verse 8 right now. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? What does all this say about me as my faith grows? I want you to think about verse 8. What does this say about me as my faith grows? In terms of this principle for Satan being active within the world today. That's exactly right. As we grow in the faith, does fighting Satan become easier? No. That is a misnomer. As I become stronger in the faith, I should be able to say no to Satan a lot easier than I have in the past. Yes, in terms of if he was using the exact same temptations he used on me 20 years earlier, but now I have grown, or I should have grown, over the course of 20 years. If I have grown like I need to do, will the degree of temptation be as light as they were 20 years ago? Go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as you are able to bear. And he is not going to allow us to be tempted above that which we are able. The stronger you become, what? That's exactly right. The more I'm able to bear, the temptations will become stronger. George?
The longer you go to church and stuff, the more faith you get to fight what the devil's got.
And you're going to have to use that. That's the point. Ken, very good.
Something I'm thinking about. There might have been things 20 years ago that I struggled with, and now I've overcome those. And the thing that Satan can use me is putting another brother or sister down that's struggling with those same things I did 20 years ago. The way I act toward that brother or sister, Satan can use me to destroy the faith of that brother and sister.
Absolutely.
And also, that's a bigger temptation where you were talking about. I mean, it's
the pride of life. That's
a specific example, the pride of life, with the arrogance and downplaying somebody else.
Peter and his temptation where he denied Jesus three times, and he was, of course, the apostle of Christ, and kind of hurt him for a long time as far as getting over it. It took him a few days to get over it.
Okay. Yeah. And again, I pointed this out before, but
out again, because it's worth thinking about every so often. So think about the magnitude of the temptations that our Lord went through. If the magnitude of the temptation is based on what you're able to bear, think about the magnitude of the temptation. It would have crushed just anybody else, but Jesus was able to say no to it. It was not an easy. The point is, it wasn't easy for Jesus to say no. He was the Son of God. Those temptations were even greater. The degree and the magnitude of them were even greater because of who he was.
When he sweat, it was blood. I mean, that's so much stress.
Yep. Now, do
the attacks of Satan negate God's providence?
stopping you from going to the cross, and couldn't really stop the resurrection. But
that's exactly right. Turn over to Romans 8.
Two passages. Why not? And turn over to Romans 8. We're going to take a look at two passages. Romans 8 and verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, them who are the called according to His purpose. What is Paul saying? How does it correspond to what we're talking about?
For us and to His purpose. You know, okay. So He's going to take care of us.
Okay. Anyone else?
Even.
What we see is good. You know, materialistically good.
Okay. So I guess it's still
how you define good. All things work to good.
Going to eat, what you're going to wear, where you're going to live. You know, the birds of the air and the lilies of the valley have all these things all provided for you for the bare necessities of life.
So define good here. What is good? Which is going to lead me to my next passage.
Sounds better to me here.
Okay.
Than good, because good would put a quantitative, you know.
So what was good for Job to go through all of this?
How was it good?
For Job.
Turn over to 1 Peter chapter 1. It was the same
way as it is for us. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3, a passage that is very familiar to many of us. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, which according to His abundant mercy hath begotten us again unto a lively hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled and fadeth not away, reserved for you in heaven, who are kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time, wherein you greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, you are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perish, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto the praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ, whom, having not seen, you love, and whom now, although now you see Him not, yet believing, you rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your souls. According to Peter, what is the purpose of the trials, of God allowing us to go through these trials and temptations that Satan placed upon Job and that he still places upon us today? What's the purpose?
Prove our faith, but there's another purpose.
To purify us.
To make us more acceptable and able to go where? When Job was done with his temptations, what does that imply about his faith? It was even stronger. Because did Job have impurities in his faith? He had to have. If he had no impurities in his faith, what was he then? Yeah, he was the Son of God. That's exactly right. So he had impurities. And those temptations and those trials that he went through burned more of them off. Jacob?
I was thinking about Hebrews 12 with the passage about God's discipline. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know all the ways that he disciplines us. Just like, I mean, may not know, be able to point to every instance in our life and say this is exactly how God worked his providence out in this situation. But the writer tells us there about God's discipline, that He disciplines us for our good, and the New American Standard puts the word "our" in italics. But just think about, you know, He disciplines us for good, so that we may share His holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterward it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. So it accomplishes good as God defines it. I mean, from God's perspective, it is for, it's ultimately for our eternal good, like in that passage you read in 1 Peter 1. But even here and now in this life, it's for our spiritual good.
Yes.
Even sometimes when we can't see that, sometimes when we want, maybe we want God to take away some burden or problem in our life so that we can have more comfort physically, God may know that it is for our benefit
what
spiritually.
I need to become more fit.
Yes. So it goes back to what Adam said just a few minutes ago. Our idea of good is probably different than God's idea. And we go back to providence and Him providing for us in the faith that we have. Is that when we're going through those difficulties, we can question. Now, there's nothing wrong with questioning. But who do you look to for the answers? God. That's who you look to for the answers. And ultimately, there may never be an answer. You may never be given an answer. Then by faith, you say, I'm going to put it in God's hands and let Him take care of me. Because He does. That's providence. And that's how it works. In the way we see things differently. Yeah.
All the suffering and trials, persecution that he endured, but he always, like 2 Corinthians 4, I mean, he was always looking at it from God's perspective, it seems.
Yeah. And so I just kind
of, one of the things, and my time's just about up, so one of the things, I just want to quickly go through this, and I got one more slide. One of the things I pointed out was, what I was thinking about, and maybe it's just from the aspect of a father and now a grandfather, I was thinking about the prodigal son's father. What did the prodigal son's father not do when the son was going and experiencing the consequences of negative decisions? Did not try to help. He had to do what? What did the prodigal son have to do? He had to learn his lesson. And you know how hard that is for a parent that loves a child? So let them learn their lesson and not come in and rescue them. Because if you rescue them, do they learn the lesson? No. Sometimes we have to let them go through the difficulties in life to learn the lessons. That's hard to do. And you know who else is hard for to do? As He watches us from above and we're going through the difficulties and the trials and the temptations, you know who it's hard for? I can't imagine. As I think about the difficulties my own children have been in their lives, and I say, you take care of it. You're the one that did this action. You're the one that spoke that word. You have to deal with it. I may give you advice, but I'm not going to give you the money. I'm not going to give you, and to go and talk to anybody. It is your responsibility to take care of this. You know how hard it would have been? I know how hard it is when I have had to say that. Do you know how hard it must have been to watch your son die on the cross? Knowing at any second you could have put him in there. Just kind of throw that out there for you to think about. Back to what we're talking about here. So as such, when we need to pray and use clear understanding to determine if we need to take that job, go to that ball game, or associate with those people. Because it may not be what God wants. It may be who wants. Or Satan wants. Yeah, which is a lot of times that the answer to that is. Satan is alive and active against us. And as we study providence, you need to understand that. There is a fourth player in all of this. As we walk through life and realize that God is in control, we need not ever forget Romans 8 and 1 Peter chapter 1. And then but therefore we walk by faith, not by sight. We trust in Jehovah with all thy heart and lean not upon thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct our paths, even through the difficult times. He has not left us. He is there. We just need to put our faith in Him and look for the way out. So the four principles of providence, and we're going to start applying them next week with Esther. Providence must be distinguished from the miraculous. He does not use the miraculous to do his will today. 2, God never operates providentially in any way that is in conflict with his nature and his revealed will. He will always be righteous. He will always be good. Principle 3, divine providence does not negate man's freedom of will. We choose what we're going to do. Everybody does. And principle 4, there is another player in all this, Satan. And we can never forget about his active role in all in the world today. So next week, the questions, you can start reading through the book of Esther. I have specific questions as we're going to walk through it. And what I want to do is after, we're going to look at different instances in Esther's life, and then we're going to apply these four principles. I got the slides all through this next section, so we can take a look and see how all of this interacts to one another, how this is all intercombined with one another as we play out the situation in the book of Esther and how it all works out. And just realize that I think Esther might be the only book in the Bible that it does not have the name of God. He's not mentioned anywhere by name, but he's all through that book. And we're going to see how he is all through that book starting next week. Thank you for your comments.